Welcome to Product Launch Labs, a podcast for anyone with a passion for matching innovative solutions with real-world market problems. It doesn't matter if you are a part of a startup or a big company, we hope that this podcast is for you because each episode, a guest will join us to share stories from real-world product launches, including the triumphant highs and the pivot-inducing lows.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
Three. Two.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
1-0.
All jokes about challenges with product launches aside, we're excited to be sharing all of these lessons learned, these best practices from taking new products to market. So let's move on to this week's guest.
I've been in several companies where I came late to the table or I was early, but there was always an iteration of the business plan. We always were trying to do something different because we either ran into a brick wall, ran out of money, ran out of interest in a certain application, or the market told us that ain't gonna work. And so it is unique to have been able to stick around for that long, but to be, like you said, generally centered on how it started is very, very indicative of how powerful the original value proposition was.
That was Tim Gurman, the Chief Commercial Officer of Cartera. And we're going to get deeper into his introduction here in a moment. But I just wanted to call out a couple of themes that I think everybody will find some value in as we go through this episode. Number one, the power of a compelling value proposition. You heard a tip to that or a nod to that here in the opening segment. Second, the importance of really hustling until the timing of product and market are a fit. Third, how to think about balancing a roadmap in the early stages of a company's growth. And then fourth, the evolving role of product management during early accelerated growth for a business. At the beginning, we're going to dive into a little bit of an explanation of the science behind Cartera's solutions. And that will provide some helpful context to the more product-focused conversations deeper into the episode. Also, if you hear a reference to Wasatch Microfluidics, that is the initial name of the company that Tim works with, Cartera, that we'll be talking about. And with that, let's jump into more of the conversation with Tim, including his introduction. Tim has broad operational experience in general management, as well as lots of deep experience in sales and marketing. And he's been the author too, and some might say, or he might say, victim of many product management functions. So he'll be a very helpful contributor to the themes that we're tackling on our podcast here. He has experience in both the life sciences and healthcare and medical devices, all of which have had product portfolios that include software as a component to that. He is currently the Chief Commercial Officer at Cartera, a privately held biotech company in Salt Lake City that spun out of the University of Utah 15 years ago with a proprietary microfluidic technology. It made incremental progress through grants and breadcrumbs for about a decade until being meaningfully funded for the first time by both Pfizer and a venture firm in 2016. And since then, it has developed and sold novel technology for drug discovery worldwide. In addition to all of those significant responsibilities, Tim maintains at work and also at home. He also carries the heavy burden of being a friend of mine. So with that, welcome to the podcast, Tim, and thanks so much for joining. Anything else you want to share about your background before we dive in?
Oh, I think the burden of being your friend just got heavier after that intro, though. Thank you.
As long as you're willing to shoulder it, then we're good.
No, I am very pleased to be here. I love talking about these disciplines, certainly everything related to general management, but specifically sales and marketing, and very pleased to be here with you. Thank you.
Our focus today is Cartera's LSA, which is a biosensor platform for therapeutic antibody discovery. Tim, for those of us not well-versed in antibody testing, can you just give us a back-of-the-napkin value proposition for the product?
Absolutely. If you think about the world that we live in today, there's a lot of talk about antibodies. And antibodies basically are the good guys that run around in your body tackling and wrestling to the ground the bad guys. You have a lot of naturally occurring antibodies, but sometimes when you get sick, you have a pathogen that's been introduced to your system. The body creates more antibodies and different kinds of antibodies. Drug companies figured this out a long time ago, and they began making drugs that weren't chemical compounds. They were actually antibodies. And in fact, about 7 of the 10 most successful drugs of all time are now antibodies. And so for those that watch a lot of television, you'll see commercials for many of these drugs, one of which is Humira, made by AbbVie. This is a $20 billion a year drug. You know, just probably a decade ago, you didn't have pharmaceutical companies that sold $20 billion a year in everything. Now you have one drug generating that much revenue. Its efficacy is broad. Its acceptance by patients and their systems, their biological systems, is well characterized. And the indications for what they can solve are numerous. And so this holy grail, which is using the body's natural systems, things like antibodies, the good guys running around tackling the bad guys, is very important for drug companies. Most of them have programs in both what are called small molecules, these are chemical compounds as drugs, and what are called biologics, essentially antibodies as drugs. And so this platform that we've developed at Cartera helps them do that at least 50 times faster than what they've done in the past couple of decades.
So in our consulting practice, we think a lot about the framework Jobs to be Done that comes from outcome-driven innovation and from Clayton Christensen. And it's remarkable how clear Tim is about the job that they're solving for and their differentiated method of solving for it. Here's a little bit more on the original start for Cartera, where it got going and what the original value proposition was. Can you tell us a bit more about what experience, what effort, what source led to the founding of Cartera? What was the origin story for the company and the product?
It's a great question. There was a need, and that's always how value propositions start, right? There was a need, even 20 years ago, with what were the existing platforms for discovering therapeutic antibodies. The need was greater throughput and greater speed. And there was a very well-known scientist here at the University of Utah, just coincidentally here at the University of Utah, named David Miska. And for those who read scientific papers, he was the founder, really the grandfather of this discipline of characterizing antibodies that could do good as drugs. And his problem in using the tools that were available was that he was not able to go very fast and do as much as he wanted to do. And so he actually worked with folks in the engineering department at the University of Utah and said, hey, is there a way that we can do this? And so one of our founders, Josh Ekman, who is our current chief executive officer, was a graduate student and worked with his advisor there in the engineering department to take what was some really seminal technology in being able to move very small amounts of fluid around, and that's what we call microfluidics. And to be able to do that with substances like antibodies. And so the combination of the need from this one very, very important scientist and the technical resource available in the engineering department married in this desire to create something that could change the way antibodies as drugs were to be discovered.
Another interesting component of the conversation with Tim was the role that that value proposition played in his decision to join Cartera. I think all of us in marketing roles can take a page out of his playbook as we evaluate organizations that we aspire to be a part of. I know there's an interest in aligning ourselves to companies that have similar values, products that interest us. But his explanation of what attracted him to Cartera is a great lesson for all of us to try and apply in our own career growth and development.
As a consultant, I took about 6 months to evaluate the commercial plan, the value proposition, the people in the business, the leadership, the investors, again, in a deeper way. And the way that it came to me, and I think the clearest way I can describe my willingness to eventually join full time, was a dynamic in the marketplace, which is not very common. And that's what I would describe as an open lane in an established market. Established markets are those that have several entrants. It's been around, you know, in this case, 20 to 30 years of being able to find therapeutic antibodies in drug discovery, but the tools had never left what was a really low throughput or very slow approach to discovering those. The fact that they had discovered some was good and encouraging, but there was no technology provider that had said, we need to do better, faster, and more of this. And so I viewed this as a significantly de-risked commercial venture because it was an established market, and yet the lane for speed and efficiency had never been addressed. And so that's what got me really excited about this opportunity. And it, in fact, it's been validated by my experience over the last 3 years, and we've begun to sell this platform all over the world. And if you look at this COVID-19 situation over the last several months, that need has increased even more. And we have companies that have come to us in the last 90 days who are used to making other kinds of drugs that have said, hey, we not only need to be in the antibody business, we're going to be doing COVID-19 research with this platform. So I was, like I said, very fortunate to be in a situation to evaluate it from a very experienced view, but also as a consultant before I jumped in whole hog.
Makes sense. And I will agree with you. That was totally cheating. And if there were such a thing, if there were such a thing as podcast points, I would extract some from you now.
There you go.
I'm curious if you could just give us some insight into how this one investment over other things was. Was there a pitch or a series of pitches involved? The grants that were given, was there a bit of a, hey, we've got to prove our worth over other things? How did it get the green light to move ahead?
This is a great question. And this is a question I think all founders would be interested in. Within your question, there are two things that come very quickly to mind. One is Josh Eckman, the CEO now and the founder at the time, did things that founders should do and do all the time. And yet there were some very unique things that occurred that make it a very special proposition. So let me focus on the first for a minute. When you're commercializing technology, it's very important to have proof points. In other words, this technology is going to solve a problem, and it's a problem that's of some significance. In other words, people want to pay for it. You're going to have to make a technology that can be manufactured robustly, and that you can't just sell once or twice, but you got to sell over and over and over again. And so Josh went about applying for government grants, applying for university grants. They won a business plan competition. All those things that good founders do when they're just hustling to keep the dream alive. This energy that comes with founders is something which is really quite unique. It is the essence of entrepreneurship. But at some point, without significant funding, many of these dreams die. They die on the vine because they're not enriched by either receptivity in the marketplace or receptivity by investment sources, whether they be government, university, or venture. And so there's a combination of the early folks, Josh included, seeking out those funding sources, making some proof points, even branching out a bit from the original proposition and saying, well, what if we could do this with it? And maybe that's a defense application, or maybe we could do this and that's still a pharmaceutical application. So there was a tug and pull, but it was really to find where there was the greatest receptivity. The special thing and the unique thing about the proposition for Wasatch Microfluidics is how long he was able to do that. Most people, either with friends and family or what they have in their pocket or the change in the couch cushions or anybody who becomes interested in it. It's not in perpetuity that you're able to chase these dreams. And one of the things that Josh did, which I've always considered a miracle as I've come, of course, late to the table over the last few years, is how long he was able to keep that dream alive to the tune of 10 years before being meaningfully funded. That's very unusual.
So all of that hustle and staying power is obviously a really important part of Cartera's story. And Tim and I ended up chatting a little bit more about how the organization evolved in prioritizing new opportunities or what the sources for new opportunities looked like, especially as he highlighted potential pivots in value proposition in that last segment. At Venturis Partners, we find that clarity regarding where new opportunities come from, what sources a company looks to, how they populate an icebox or a treasure chest, this roadmap of things that have yet to be analyzed come from, that concept of those types of roadmaps and where the sources are that drive them is one that doesn't get a lot of attention, which can lead to an overfocus on maintenance. But in this case, because of Cartera's growth situation, where they are in their evolution, it was interesting to hear Tim talk about what the sources are and how that's changed or adapted over time as well.
You learn so much by being in front of dozens and dozens of customers, by getting scraped up on the playground. That's the way I would describe it. If you're watching kids play, you sort of get a sense for why it's fun, why it might be a little dangerous, why it might be exhilarating, but you really don't know that until you are swinging on a swing and decide to jump off at its height, right? That feeling you don't have until you're doing it. And I think that's true in small businesses, particularly technology businesses. There was a portfolio when I walked in the door 3 years ago of not only the existing product that we were building and going to launch, but follow-on products. With market feedback, direct market feedback from customers and people who have not bought the platform, but for other reasons, you know, maybe they weren't well qualified as prospects, we've collected a lot of information as to where research is going, the interests of researchers, and what we want to do. And what I would say is that, again, because the founders had been at this for 10 years, they had done a lot of that. But even then, until you're out on the playground getting your knees scraped up, you don't have the resolution on really what should go next, how quickly it should go next, how much it's going to cost, what the market size is that's available to you. And so the process for us has been a bit of what was already in the can for ideas around next products and then exactly what customers have told us. And obviously, having an installed base gives you an advantage to be able to number and talk to the customers, but also place new products if they are tangential or follow-on products in your portfolio.
The natural follow-up to those comments from Tim was, whose job is it inside of Cartera to monitor the market, to observe what's happening out there in the marketplace? And he shared some interesting insights relative to a company of Cartera's size in their earlier stages of growth and whose job that is. And I think this is particularly important for anybody in a product management career who's evaluating their participation with an early stage organization. It makes a difference because the role that you're expected to play and those people who are monitoring and actively observing what the market's doing and thinking about what that means for the portfolio is, for very good reason, somewhat different.
As you bring other people into an organization, and that isn't just the functional leaders and the line employees, it's also the investors. So the investors have taken their limited partners' money and placed a bet on your company. They've already told a story to somebody. They've told a story that we're going to go invest in companies like this, doing things like this, that are going to target this. And that's how they raise money and that's how they invest money. So there's a filter that goes across the top that says, hey, this is the kind of company you are. So that's a lot of where it starts. You also have the market feedback. We've just talked a lot about that. That's going to be a lot of it. And you have, you know, founders are generally idea generating machines. So we have a founder like that who is constantly thinking about ways to monetize versions of the technology, either in improvements to existing or existing product or in next generation products. And then you have members of the management team that have come from all over the industry that have experience just like mine, but their own, right? And so when you bring all of that together, there is a management team that works on strategy. Members of the management team work on strategy. You measure that against the guidance from the board. We have investors who are pure investors, and then we have board members who are independents, typically been CEOs in the life sciences and in healthcare. So everybody has a stake in where the company's going. And when it's right, generally that surfaces in a way that everybody says, aha, there might be a little disagreement on how fast to go, how much money to spend on it, or whether or not you should partner or maybe out-license that next great idea. But it is the responsibility at this stage in our company, for instance, that you have a combination of investors, independent board members, the management team, and the feedback from the market.
Clearly, the process of sourcing new opportunities from the market at Cartera is one that's not just collaborative at the product management layer, but all the way up to, as he called out, board members, investors, management team members, et cetera. And so then that begs the question, how do they handle this idea of which thing first and why? Like we always talk about, prioritize or die. You have to choose. Choosing or not choosing is just a vote in favor of not delivering anything to market. And so here are some of Tim's thoughts on how they do that at Cartera.
I think ours is, you know, I've worked with a lot of boards, worked obviously with a lot of management teams. I think ours is not non-traditional. I think it's relatively traditional. And what happens is you have people who know strategy well. So let's just say the CEO on the technical side, me over the commercial organization. We have a VP of marketing, of course, that has a lot of industry experience. And you have the engineering team that can tell you immediately, that's nutty. We're never going to be able to make that, or it's going to take us some time and we're going to need a lot of money. Yep. Once that coalesces around a concept or two, there's some socialization with board members and with customers that happens. And you actually get to, I wouldn't say it's a consensus. Consensus means everybody, but I would say there is generally an endorsement by the management team, customers, and investors that this is the direction you should go. So it isn't, there are meetings, there are board meetings, and for instance, where you're gonna approve large expenditures and you're gonna approve an effort to go do something specifically. And that does happen. We do make those decisions. But in terms of product strategy, it's a little bit rounder on the edges than something like that. And it usually, like I said, it's an endorsement of various groups, not necessarily 100% consensus.
I really want to highlight how Tim's comments there about prioritization are another tip of the hat toward how an organization needs to evolve over time. Structure and process that sits within the boundaries of strategy, thinking about the Designing Dynamic Organizations model or framework from Jay Galbraith. Those two things have to change over time. Right now, that model, that pattern makes a lot of sense for Cartera based on where they are. And over time, they're going to continue to adapt and evolve as the organization changes when their revenue grows. The natural follow-up to Tim's thoughts on prioritization is the balance of what you've prioritized across various horizons of opportunity, near-term, mid-term, and long-term new product development opportunities and initiatives that could be pursued. But you need to balance across those three, and Tim shared some really great insights on how they think about that in a smaller organization versus the way that they would think about it as they grow and things change for them in the future. So here is the discussion that he and I had on that subject. As you are evaluating these opportunities, these market-driven opportunities or initiatives that come onto the table, today, at the size that you're dealing with, just the organizational complexity that you have, there's obviously significant engagement from the leadership team, the management team in monitoring those things. What is the process by which you evaluate the push and pull that exists between responding to customer-driven, near-term sustaining changes in the product versus the things that you might focus on that will make a difference in revenue 3 years from now. That's such a tough concept. And when you've got such an intimate relationship with your customers, like it sounds like Cartera does, how do you manage the push and pull between those two categories of opportunity?
I'd like to do a step back and say, though, it is different for different companies at different sizes. When you have a portfolio of mature products, maybe a new product, you're on a cadence of releasing a new product, particularly in technology, let's say every 18 months. How you evaluate that and how, and when you're a profitable business, you know, how important it is to get that right is relative. For us, where we've launched one platform, it is the source of revenue today. When you think about sustaining, you're actually thinking about making the product be what customers have asked for and maybe what you intended. Maybe what was launched had a couple of features that you didn't get to. You know, everybody's experienced the delays in either engineering or manufacturing or whatever. And so if we were to look back and say, hey, what we drew up 3-4 years ago, is it exactly what launched? There were a couple of things I think we are finishing. And that comes from that sustaining request from a customer. It comes from our own desire to make the product better. But it is the one thing that drives us today. Whereas if you have a company with a lot of those, that decision is a little bit differently. So we have prioritized, for instance, product reliability, the customer experience, serviceability, all of those things in the existing product. And we spent more time and energy on that than, say, maybe new product development in recent months, because we really want to focus and make sure that this first foray, at some point we can spike the football, right? And say, this has been amazing. It's now installed, and it is all over the world. And it runs, and we never have to go service it. And we're approaching that, right? That's exactly what we want to do. But I think it's just relative in terms of how you emphasize which product and this push and pull that you talked about. For us, of course, we have the one product, and so it's a big focus for us.
So I'm gonna say this back to you just to make sure I've got it right, and then I want to emphasize this point for those who are grappling with a similar challenge. So we use the there are various models that you can think about when it comes to balancing product initiatives. The three horizons from the Alchemy of Growth, the McKinsey model. You've got Improve, Grow, Transform. Reid Hoffman talks about, I believe it's core vision and transform. They've all settled on this idea of three buckets. And if what I'm hearing right is, if I'm hearing it right, what you're saying is that in the size of the organization that you are today, perhaps the improve and grow buckets are actually one and the same, and there's no need to differentiate yet. And there will come a time where it would be a good idea to divide those into improve, meaning next 12 months, things that we're going to do to protect the customers we have today, versus grow, that aims at, say, the 18 to 36 month type timeline. But for now, improvement and growth is really synonymous.
Exactly.
Does that sound right?
I completely agree. What happens with a new product, particularly a first product, is you can stare at it and you can use it in-house for thousands of hours, and you can have as many people in your company, you know, test the software for, again, thousands of hours. And it isn't until you actually install the product on four continents in dozens and dozens of customers who have paid now, in our case, $500,000 for a very, very important research tool. It isn't until then that those various sets of eyes in various cultures and climes come together to say, it is perfect, or it is not perfect, and here's the list. And yeah. So it's impossible for a company launching its first product to move quickly into some growth model without actually locking down what they've launched and then transition over some period of time. You put some months on it, but it's different for everybody. We've been very fortunate. The instrument, the value proposition is so strong that wherever we may have had shortcomings, customers have been so patient. And And if there's something in the software that wasn't ideal and they developed a workaround, they're excited to tell us about the workaround. We're not excited to hear that they have a workaround.
Yeah.
But they're excited that they've developed a workaround because the value proposition, again, of the platform is so substantial. So we've been very fortunate, but we've also been very diligent at maintaining those resources with this first product out of the gate. We have plenty of time to launch new products and grow and get into those other phases as you describe them. Once you've established yourself with a product that looks and feels and performs like what you intended, even with maybe some modifications based on initial customer feedback, you're actually going to decrease investment potentially over time and increase on the new product. So I think that's what you mean, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a pot of gold, a pot of money that could be used for a variety of things, some percentage of the overall budget. And it could be used for the existing product, for new products, for new features on the existing product, whatever it may be. And the balance of that as a percentage of the whole, there are benchmarks for when you have to decide, well, should that investment be bigger, smaller? Should it be dedicated just to this product or other products? How have you managed keeping tabs on what that budget should be?
There's a couple things. One obviously is your current product performance. You have to look at how well the current product performs in the hands of customers. And I'm not talking about sales execution necessarily. That is a metric, but that doesn't tell you, because sales execution is really outside of product performance. And it doesn't give you an indication of market acceptance. In fact, it could actually cloud that calculation if you put too much of data from sales execution. But if you look at what customers are saying and the uptake and the rate at which they're adopting, and in our business, the rate at which they're publishing, right? So we work with a lot of industrial customers. They don't publish as much as their intellectual property, but they still publish scientifically why these things are important. They love sharing when they use and do new things. And that's true throughout academia as well. So you look at, in our business, the rate of publications, the performance of the current product. We use Net Promoter Score. We also use customer satisfaction, both for usability, reliability, but also service and support. And so of the current product, those are the metrics. Of the potential new product, we of course use the market feedback. We do talk to KOLs, key opinion leaders in the space. We measure product ideas, but then when there's a little bit more definition around the product idea, we actually move to talking to people that are not just key opinion leaders, but that actually could be early adopters. And sometimes those are very different people. So I think those are the sets of metrics for the current product and the potential new product. And then that drives the investment, which is kind of how you started your question.
Yep.
We have established an amount of investment that is what you've referred to as sustaining or sustaining engineering. And then we will allot a certain amount of money for new product development. And we think we know what that's going to cost technically. I mean, it's a roll up, right? You have the engineering folks, you have the marketing folks, sales folks included, and then the finance people put that through a threshing machine to come up with a number. But there are many components to that once you decide that you're actually going to go and develop a new product. A lot of this is leadership, right? The leadership, and that's of the management team, but also from the CEO, sets an expectation and accountability around certain things. And so if you aren't either held accountable or you aren't asked about this over here, you may go off and do that over there. And so a lot of it has to do with the way that the accountability is structured within the management team to ensure that while it's good to have attention about getting to new products and new product development, that we have a very robust, sustaining process for those products that are already launched.
A lot of this episode thus far has focused a lot on the role of management, investors, the founder, et cetera, in the role that they play in monitoring the market and playing the role of strategic product management, just based on where they're at in their evolution. And that makes a ton of sense. We did actually end up having a great conversation about the role of product management, because they do have product managers at Cartera. The role that they play and why that role makes so much sense now, And I think it also does a great job of signaling what role that that will need to play, that product management will need to play as the organization changes. Here's a bit of that interchange on the role of product management at Cartera.
That's a super question, a very timely. In fact, we've created a role just this year, in the past 12 months, I guess, not this calendar year, but certainly in the last 12 months, for this very type of person that you were talking about. I'll explain a little bit about that. In my experience in this company and in other companies, there's a very specific need in what I would call the upstream marketing function, which includes product management, to link arms with those who actually have to develop the product. So whether that's software engineers, hardware engineers, there has to be somebody that sits in the commercial organization that is speccing out requirements and making sure that there's a relationship that is functional with clear communication, much of which has to be documented, such that the folks on the technical side know exactly what they need to do. And typically that's what they want. They want to know what they need to do in grave detail. Those people sometimes are professional marketing people. They are product managers who are trained in the art. They're devoted to this. They love it. And I've had those people in organizations. I've deployed them in this very, important commercial role, but it is a commercial role. You have other companies where there's so much technical about what you're doing that unless the marketing person comes to the table with domain expertise, it's difficult for them to actually marshal the process. They could manage a process, but the details behind it, maybe it's a stretch. And so we actually took a scientist who had recently completed an MBA, and created a role that is the technical product manager. So this is someone who not only is a scientist, but became a super user on our current initial product and platform, who's been in the field, knows customers, but also had a desire to leverage that experience and the scientific background in driving new product development. And so we created a role that wasn't just a traditional product management role, but was a technical product management role. And I've done this in other businesses, and it really is magic. When they can do the translational work of customer requirements, value proposition, and also understand a bit about how technically the engineering and applications people are going to get there, it goes a lot faster and a lot smoother. We've been very fortunate in that regard, but I'm a big believer in not only product management, but certainly technical product management when required.
At Venturous Partners, we do have a lot of cases where we are working with clients on sourcing the right type of product managers. We always talk about a three-legged stool for product managers. There's business acumen, there's domain expertise, and then there's product management discipline expertise.
Exactly.
And you're
totally
kind of
agree.
Looking for this sweet spot. The interesting thing is, and this is one thing that I'd love to focus on as we're talking about this, the role of product, particularly upstream product management in an organization, it obviously has to change and flex in different bands of growth for organizations. In the early stages, the founder is the product manager.
Exactly.
That's what they are. They have their fingers on the pulse of the market. They cover all three of those domains. Nobody believes in the value proposition more than the founder does. Then the organization grows, and the very first need that comes about, you just articulated this really perfectly, is this product owner or technical product manager role that's not so much a finder, a hunter for new interesting opportunities, watching where the market's headed, but a translator, somebody with a gift and ability to take all of these inputs and to translate it into something that the development machine can consume in an effective way. Is your organization actively monitoring how that needs to continue to change, or is this new enough or fresh enough with just 12 months as having a TPM on the team that's kind of a ways out for you guys and watching how that needs to flex again?
Yeah, I think you asked one question, which I'm going to answer, but buried within that is a second question. One question is about the process itself. And the answer to your question is yes, we absolutely are monitoring the ability of the upstream marketing folks to do that translational work, drive processes, communicate effectively, and then of course measure output. But what was buried in that question is you have a new guy doing this who is new to these kinds of roles. How is he doing personally? And so right. We do both. We're doing both. We're doing both the process evaluation and the individual evaluation. We couldn't be more pleased with the individual. He's just so talented, spent about 10 years in a pharmaceutical company in the kinds of labs where we sell our platform today doing research, came to us about 6 years ago and spent time in the field working with customers, but was really always in a scientific role, helping customers doing those things that he had done for 10 years in pharma. Now he is doing the job of good upstream marketing folks. And so we couldn't be more pleased with the decision to go in this direction, his input, but I think the process in total, we continue to evaluate, and by no means are we perfect in this. And so we are measuring communication channels. We're measuring frequency of communication as well, and making sure the right people in the organization are involved. So like you said, we've grown very quickly. And so there are times when some people get left behind, not meaningfully, or not because somebody wanted to leave them behind. We're just going really fast. We didn't think, oh gosh, that person absolutely needs to be in this meeting or reviewing this document or reviewing these specifications. So we're getting better at it, not perfectly yet, but we are very glad we made the decision.
I think this is really an interesting point and a critical one for executives at companies of any size as they're looking to staff or mature or grow product teams. You hear product managers or even people who are not yet in product management, they say, I want to be a product manager. Well, product management means something very different depending on the context or the organization that it's a part of. And we've just talked about one case here. And so as executives are looking for people to lead product functions or people to staff those functions, it is so important and will reap tremendous benefit later if you look for somebody that's got a mindset that fits where that organization is today, not 5 years down the road. Because if you go find somebody who is more interested in, for those that know the pragmatic marketing framework, the upper left component, the strategic product side of things, searching for, doing analysis on the market, whether it's win-loss or pure observation and research, and that driving new opportunities and a strategic roadmap, that kind of person will be frustrated if they're coming into a scenario where they're lumping improve and grow into one category because it's the right thing to do. And they're gonna fight against that. So I think hopefully there's a lesson learned there for those that get a chance to listen to our podcast here to think about the product persona that they would pursue for their organization. So I really appreciate you sharing a bit more about that. We are nearing the end of our podcast today. This episode of Product Launch Labs, Tim has shared a ton about the way to think about strategy, structure, process, and people relative to product management in a smaller, earlier stage growth organization. It's been really exciting to have him on the podcast. Here are a few more things on how to connect with him before we wrap up for good on today's episode of the podcast. Any parting shots, anything you want to share about the utopian future that will certainly come to pass because of Cartera?
Well, number one, thank you for having me. This is, as you can tell, I love to talk about aspects of business in addition to my own business. And would always welcome any questions or other dialogue from anybody who may listen to the podcast. Certainly grateful to have had the opportunity to spend some time with you today. Secondly, I am very fortunate to be in this organization. We give a lot of credit to those that helped found the business, but in the end, a product had to be made, it had to work, it had to get sold, and it had to get sold over and over and over again. And that really drives everyone's, of course, individual success objectives, but certainly as a business, it's driven the value of our company, the attention that we get both for future investment or acquisition or whatever kinds of things happen over time to a business. We've been very fortunate. We're in a very good spot, but I appreciate the opportunity to highlight that today. I would welcome direct communication. You're welcome to reach out to me. You can reach me by addressing a message through our info@cartera-bio.com, or you can reach me directly at my email, which is tgerman, so T-G-E-R-M-A-N-N @cartera-bio.com. Take any questions or follow up.
Excellent. And for those keeping track at home, and we'll include this in the notes that come with this episode, that's Cartera, that's C-A-R-T-E-R-R-A. And once again, Tim, thanks so much for joining, and we've appreciated your participation, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Best wishes. Stay safe.
Once again, a special thanks to Tim German from Cartera for joining us today. We at Venturous Partners are really grateful we get to do this, thrilled to try and share insights on the things that have to exist in an organization for a product to be successful. If you have any feedback for us, you're welcome to share at venturouspartners.com. There's a section on the website relative to product launch labs. And in the meantime, we really appreciate having you. And we hope that all of your projects get funded, your ideas get the green light, and that your products are being adopted out there by buyers and users like wildfire. Until next time, I'm Jacob Hansen, and thanks for joining.